Hey, this is Andrew. I'm the Executive Director of Literary Arts and also the host of the Archive Project. Here at Literary Arts, we're at our year-end campaign, and so much of our programming here online or out in the community, things like Wordstock, are accessible or low cost. We can do that because people like you give. You can help keep us accessible for our whole community by making a gift today at literary-arts.org. And thank you. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from Reza Aslan, the famed religious scholar, writer, producer, and television commentator. Aslan joined us as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2017, and he came to discuss his new book, God, A Human History. In this talk, Aslan addresses the curious tendency of humanity to personify God, and he goes deep in our history, indeed into our prehistory, to trace this arc across the ages. This arc matters because by investigating it, Aslan goes to the heart of one of the most fundamental human mysteries. Why do we believe? Is faith some kind of adaptive advantage produced in the evolutionary process? And if so, how? If not, then where does it come from? Are we hardwired for it? Why does faith persist? Aslan brings new insights to these age-old questions by discussing the latest archaeological discoveries and research, combined with the most recent historical theories, drawing a line straight into contemporary life. What makes this talk so compelling is Aslan's vast cross-cultural and historical knowledge of religion and his passion for the subject. He is a master translator of this material for a wide audience, and his pop culture sensibility brings humor and relevance to everything he touches on. Here's Aslan.
Thank you. I want to make sure everybody can hear me okay. It's such an absolute delight to be back to Portland, one of my favorite cities in the world. Portland. Yeah, it's actually been 2 years since I've stood on this stage. I came here 2 years ago to give a lecture on behalf of the World Affairs Council, and I talked about Islamophobia in America, so we took care of that problem. It's fine now. Tonight, I thought what we would do is we would talk about something far less contentious and controversial, God. I mean, what could go wrong? Let's start in the beginning, shall we? There are countless myths of creation in the long and intimately linked history of religions. There are those myths in which a god acts upon some kind of primal matter, and in doing so, creates form and order out of chaos. Take Atum, the Egyptian creator god, the world finisher, as he's known. Atum spent an eternity floating above the primordial waters of creation until he finally came to a sacred mound called the Benben. He established himself on the mound, and then, you know, being the only creature in the universe, he did what all men do when they're bored and alone. He masturbated. By the way, guys, that's the only time you should ever masturbate, is when nobody else is around. It's the only time when it's okay. Atum masturbated into the primordial waters, and out of that arose the first gods of Egypt, Isis and Osiris, Nephthys and Set. In some creation myths, the creator is an artisan or a craftsman who physically fashions something out of nothing with his hands. Napi, the creator god of the Blackfoot Indians, was an old man who traversed the length and breadth, the breadth of the world, and he used his tools to carve out valleys and streams. He scooped up the earth with his bare hands to create mountains. He planted the forests and the meadows. Often, creation is an accident. Sometimes, you know, the byproduct of some kind of divine sexual union. Take the Mesopotamian gods Apsu and Tiamat. Apsu, the god of fresh waters, and Tiamat, the goddess of the seas. When these two gods merged in body and soul, they gave birth to creation. The very first gods arose from their divine union. Lahmu, whose name means mud, and his sister Lahamu, whose name means silt. Often, the creative act is the result of some kind of primal murder or sacrifice, some sort of death or destruction out of which creation arises. Fanku, the creator god of China, was born in an egg-shaped universe. Inside the egg was no thing, but inside no thing was Fanku. He burst forth from the egg, a giant covered in hair, and with his tools, he separated the earth from the sky. The earth became yin, the sky became yang, opposites, yet interdependent. And then when Fanku died, his skull became the dome of the sky, his blood became the rivers and the streams, his bones became the mountains, his breath became the wind, his death rattle became the thunder. And then, of course, there are those creation stories in which creation is a deliberate act, when a lonesome god sitting on some kind of cosmic throne suddenly gives voice to a thought, let there be, and then just as suddenly, there is. But what all of these creation stories have in common is the belief that humanity was created by the gods and in their image, whether to serve them or to love them, as slaves or as equals, accidentally or on purpose, with delight or with regret. God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them male and female. He created them. I've been studying the religions of the world for most of my adult life, and I can tell you with a fair measure of confidence that whether you believe in one God or many gods or no God at all, it is we who have created God in our image, not the other way around. In fact, the thesis of my book is that you could look at the entirety of human spirituality, the entire history of religious expression, and what you will see is one long, ever-evolving, and remarkably cohesive attempt to make sense of God by giving God our personality and our attributes, our emotions, our motivations, our strengths and our weaknesses, our vices, our virtues, even our own bodies. In short, by making God a human being. Until, of course, in the person of Jesus Christ, God literally becomes a human being. Now, I want to be clear about something. I'm not saying that there's no such thing as God or that God is just some kind of human construct. That may be true, but it's not something that I'm interested in. I have no interest in having a conversation about whether or not God exists. I'm not here to prove one way or the other because there ain't no proof. Faith is a choice. I often say that anyone who tells you otherwise is trying to convert you. So you can just ignore it. Faith is not a rational thing. It's an experiential thing. It's an emotion, like love or any other emotion. It is fundamentally a choice that you get to make yourself. You either believe that there is something beyond the material realm, something real, something that you can know and experience, or you don't. If, like me, you do, well, then you should ask yourself another question. Does that matter to you? Do you care? Do you want to experience that thing, whatever it is, however you want to define it? Do you want to know it? If so, then it helps, though it is by no means necessary, to have a language with which to express what is fundamentally an inexpressible thing. And that's what religion is. You know, beyond the temples and the priesthoods and the do's and the don'ts and the dogmas and the doctrines, all religion is a language that we use to express our faith. It's a language made up of symbols and metaphors to help us communicate to ourselves, to other like-minded people, the ineffable experience of faith. The point that I'm trying to make is that throughout human history, there has been one symbol, one grand symbol, one you know, overarching metaphor for God from which all other metaphors and all other symbols in all the religions of the world have arisen. And that symbol is us, the human being. More specifically, Morgan Freeman. I mean, it's my image of God. In fact, whether you are aware of it or not, whether you are a believer or not, what the vast majority of us think about when we think about God is a divine version of ourselves. Now, what is really interesting about this is that we kind of have no choice. It's hardwired in our brains. It is, in a sense, part of just the cognitive processes. It's how our brain functions. It's how our brain works. In fact, if you go back deep into our evolutionary past, back to the moment in which the very concept of God arose in human evolution, you will see that we have always had this kind of cognitive impulse towards humanizing the divine. Now, obviously, when we're talking about things like the origins of religious experience, or you know, where God came from, or the evolutionary reasons for religion, these are complex and debatable topics, right? They're questions that we've been asking ourselves for a very, very long time. What is the origins of religious experience? Why did our ancient ancestors believe in such things as spiritual beings? Is it just something that our species has, this impulse towards spiritual belief, or is it something that could be found in previous species of human beings? These are, as I say, quite difficult concepts and questions, and they've been asked for centuries. What is absolutely undeniable, what there is complete unanimity on, is that the religious experience is a fundamental feature of the human experience. And in fact, that you can, in a sense, really look at all cultures throughout all history and see that expression of religiosity. That whatever it is, this impulse that we have, goes back deep, deep in our prehistoric past. The question is, how deep? Now, usually the way that we answer this question is through material evidence, right? We dig things up, we date them, we interpret them, and then we try to come up with some sort of conclusion about their meaning and what it says about the origins of human spirituality. The good news is that we have a lot of stuff. We've dug up a lot of things. And we can look at them and we can make certain conclusions about them. We have evidence of temples. This is called Göbekli Tepe. It's a Turkish word that means pot-bellied hill. We know that this is a religious site because there is no evidence that anyone lived anywhere near this thing. Usually when we find a temple or something like that, we will often find houses nearby, right? Hearts, you know, the evidence that there were people who lived around this structure. But what's remarkable about Göbekli Tepe is that there is no evidence anyone lived anywhere near this thing. And so the logical conclusion, people debate this, but the logical conclusion is that this must have been a sacred site. It must have been a place of religious significance, a temple of a sort. In other words, people must have come to this place from miles away. People who would have spoken different languages, who would have had different cultures, who would have worshipped different gods. And yet, they would come to this place, united together, and essentially focus their devotion on a singular symbol. And we, turns out, know what that symbol is, because those two T-shaped pillars are not just abstract symbols, they're actually humanoid. They have arms, they wear loincloths, some of them wear necklaces. We don't know what they mean. There's symbols inscribed all over them, and we don't have the ability to actually translate those symbols yet. They may be different gods, they may be, you know, myths about the particular god, but what is clear is that even at this stage, what we are seeing is the concrete expression of this humanizing impulse. Göbekli Tepe is about anywhere between 12 and 14,000 years old, so just for context, that's about 6,000 years older than Stonehenge and at least 7,000 years older than the pyramids. So we can say with a good measure of confidence that at least 14,000 years ago, here we have the evidence for sophisticated religious expression. But we can go way back further than that. One of the other great finds that we have in order to talk about the origins of the religious experience is the spectacularly painted caves that dot the landscape of Europe and Asia. Although, of course, they can be found as far afield as Australia and the islands of Indonesia. There are even, of course, painted caves here in North America, though they're obviously much, much newer. These caves are a source of enormous attention. You know, there's an enormous amount of conversations about what these caves actually meant. There are scholars who believe that this is nothing more than the equivalent of like caveman graffiti, that there's no spiritual significance to this at all. But that is most definitely the minority view. A lot of people actually think that what these caves indicate is some kind of like hunting magic, right? That basically our prehistoric ancestors went into these caves, they would make a drawing or an etching of an animal, and then the idea was that somehow in doing so that would help them go out and hunt that animal, that there was this kind of transactional process that was taking place. That's the traditional viewpoint of this, but it's spectacularly wrong. There is actually no correlation whatsoever between the animals that are painted in this cave and the animals that provided the diet of the artists, of the people who did the painting. We have uncovered numerous mounds of bones of animals that were fed upon near these caves, and there's no correlation at all. In fact, at no point really are any of these animals ever really depicted as being hunted or killed. There's really no sign of violence at all in these caves. We do have some animals that have lines that are crisscrossing their bodies, and traditionally that's been interpreted as spears going in the body of the animals, but a close examination, and it's very clear that these lines are not entering the animal, they're actually emanating from the animal. That if anything, what they represent is the animal's aura or soul, to use, you know, anachronistic term. Our ancient ancestors didn't go into these caves to paint the world that they knew. What would be the point of that? What they wanted to do was to create their vision of the other world, the world beyond. In fact, many of these animals aren't even real animals. Some of them are just bizarre hybrids of other animals. Many of them, at least 70 of them, are human-animal hybrids. These are not meant to be real things, real beings. This was an expression of some conception of Paleolithic spirituality. In fact, what's even more fascinating is that there is plenty of evidence to indicate that the cave itself, not just the pictures that were painted or carved in the cave, but the actual cave itself was meant to act as a kind of a temple, like a subterranean sanctuary, that the process of entering and walking through these caves was deliberately designed in such a way to elicit a spiritual experience. That's why so many of the animals are placed in these very difficult to reach places, whether, you know, in nooks or inside of caverns, places where you would have to stand at a particular angle in order to see it, and only maybe one or two at a time. Most interestingly is this theory that when we see so many of these painted caves, we see animals that are superimposed on each other. It's almost like, you know, an artist began to draw something and then changed his mind and then drew something on top of it. Or maybe one artist drew a horse and then later on someone came and drew another horse on top of it. But almost in all of these caves, what we see is the animals sort of bunched together in this tangle. And for a long time, we had no idea what that meant, until we started recognizing that in reality, this is not, you know, different animals superimposed on each other, but they are deliberately created in a way to mimic motion. The point being that as you walked through these caves, the animals became alive. What was taking place inside these subterranean sanctuaries was clearly some kind of expression, some spiritual sense of something else that was going on. The oldest caves that we have, that we found in Europe, date to about 40,000 years old. But here's the cool thing. We've now discovered a cave on the remote islands of Indonesia that looks very much like these caves, full of animals, animals that are native to Indonesia, but nevertheless painted in very much the same way, that's also 40,000 years old. So think about this for a minute. So around the same time that Europeans first entered Europe, 40,000 years ago, we were creating the same kinds of caves in the same way at the exact same time on opposite sides of the planet. The only, you know, logical conclusion is that this is an impulse, a skill that we brought into Europe and Asia with us, something that perhaps even predates our exodus from Africa. In fact, even cooler than that, we now have caves that we've discovered that we've recently dated to anywhere between 42 and 43,000 years old in Europe, which means that they weren't painted by Homo sapiens, they were painted by Neanderthals. And if the idea of Neanderthal spirituality kind of blows your mind, well, you should realize that it's actually not that weird. Just last year, in 2016, in France's Éveron Valley, we discovered this incredible find. Dozens and dozens of gigantic stalagmites that had been broken and then deliberately placed in concentric circles around a central altar, kind of like a prehistoric Stonehenge, you know? That's the way to think about this. This was recently carbon dated. Last year, it was carbon dated to 176,000 years ago. That's nearly 100,000 years before we left Africa. So this is a Neanderthal site. But we can even go further than that, actually. One of the best examples that we have of, you know, material evidence for human spirituality is in graves. You know, the very idea of burying the dead is in and of itself a spiritual exercise. There's no reason to bury the dead. It makes much more sense to just leave the body out, let it be picked by the birds or taken away by the animals. It's far more materially expensive in terms of time and resources to go through the process of digging a hole and putting a body into it. So just that alone, just the idea that we buried our dead is an indication that there's something else happening here. But when you start looking at the ways in which these bodies were buried, whether positioned in the fetal position or stretched out with the head facing the east for the rising sun, often almost in every case, we've seen burials of trinkets, precious objects, shells, necklaces, tools, weapons, things that obviously the person needed in whatever life was to come. The bodies would sometimes be placed on flowers. They would be dusted with red ochre. The color red is a sort of a symbol for life. It was often the case that actually the head would be removed from the bodies, the brain scooped out and devoured by the family. The idea was that the brain was the seat of the essence. Again, the soul, if you don't mind me using that word. That's where it resided, in the brain. And so therefore consuming the brain was a way of absorbing the dead person, you know, into oneself. The oldest graves that we have for Homo sapiens go back to about 120,000 years old, but we have found numerous Neanderthal grave sites that also express unambiguous signs of ritual behavior. And we have even discovered some Homo erectus graves that may indicate ritual behavior. And I say may because the bones are so old, hundreds of thousands of years old, that it's really difficult to be certain whether what you are seeing is the deliberate positioning of bones or whether it's some sort of environmental causes that created the bones to be put in this way. But still, we're talking a couple of 100,000 years old that we can trace these kinds of graves. But we can go even further than that. Some of the funnest, the most exciting material evidence that we have to indicate the presence of spiritual experience are idols. Specifically, what has come to be called the Venus figurines, which is an unfortunate term because it has absolutely nothing to do with Venus. In fact, these things are tens of thousands of years older than the very concept of Venus as a goddess, but they're mostly women, and so we just, for some reason, refer to them all as Venus figurines. These idols, as I say, mostly women, almost wholly women, almost always pregnant women, round, distended bellies, plump breasts. As with the graves and with the temples and with the caves, there is debate whether this actually has religious significance or not. There are some scholars, some archaeologists, who say that this is essentially nothing more than kind of like Paleolithic porn, basically. That's what this is. I should mention, by the way, that in the history of the world, no female archaeologist has ever held that position. It's not what it is. I mean, many of these have little divots in the head, and we have found the presence of resin, which means that they must have burned some kind of incense on them. Oftentimes, the face is deliberately left uncarved or veiled in some way. So in other words, to kind of indicate that this isn't meant to be representative of a woman, but it's supposed to represent womanness. The Venus of Willendorf is 29,000 years old. One of the absolute coolest of these Venus figurines is the so-called double Venus of Grimaldi. This is affectionately known as Beauty and the Beast. And the reason is it's actually two figures. So you can see on this side is exactly what you would expect, a pregnant woman, distended breasts, that's her uncarved face. But in this particular case, she's attached to the head and the legs to this mythical monster, this serpentine horned beast. And clearly you can tell that this was meant to be an object of religious devotion. It has a hole in it. So we know that it was meant to be worn as an amulet of some sort, a talisman, if you will. The double Venus of Grimaldi is 24,000 years old, but it gets cooler. I get excited about this stuff. Not too long ago, we found in Israel something that we now refer to as the Barakat Ram Venus. It's a pregnant woman with round, plump breasts. It's basically a lump of rock. It's about 35 millimeters tall. This was dated a few years ago to minimum 300,000 years. That means it was created 100,000 years before our species even existed. Now, I could do this all day, okay? I could just keep going and going and going. because it's so much fun. But there's a problem here. The problem when we rely on material evidence to date the origins of religious experience is that, number one, we're just going to keep finding things, right? We're just going to keep finding things that are older and older and older and older, and we're going to have to just keep fixing our timelines over and over again. More importantly, however, is that beliefs don't fossilize, you know? Ideas aren't things that you bury in the ground so that thousands of years later you can dig them up. That's not how it works. I mean, the Barakat Ram Venus is 300,000 years old. That's astonishing. But it's crazy to think that the belief that gave birth to the Barakat Ram Venus is also 300,000 years old. I mean, obviously, we believed things for thousands of years before we actually expressed those beliefs by carving them out of rock or painting them in a cave or building them out in the open. And so, in a way, it's not really helpful to just rely on material evidence to talk about such things as the origins of religious experience. We have to think differently about it. We have to stop thinking about the thing itself and instead start thinking about the mind that it took to make that thing. And that's where the really exciting stuff is happening now about the origins of religious experience. We have to all begin with this one fundamental truth about religion, and that is that religion is, first and foremost, a neurological phenomenon. That the religious experience is the result of complex electrochemical reactions in the brain. Now, your response to what I just said, the proper response to what I just said, should be, so? So? Everything. Everything is the result of complex electrochemical reactions in your brain. Everything. Every experience you have ever had, every emotion you have ever had, my experience of being here talking to you, your experience of listening to me, all of it is just electrochemical reactions in your brain. So why wouldn't faith also be the result of electrochemical reactions in your brain? It drives me insane, this sort of unthinking response that sometimes you hear from people who say, well, you know, now that we know the neural mechanics through which the faith experience arises, therefore faith isn't a real experience. What? We know the neural mechanics through which love is experienced. That doesn't make love any less of a legitimate emotion. It certainly doesn't devalue the object of love. Why would it do that with faith? Of course faith exists in your brain. Everything exists in your brain. It doesn't delegitimize the faith experience, and it most definitely doesn't devalue the object of your faith. But it does, I think, bring up a very important point, which is that if you really want to find out, if you really want to talk about the origins of the religious experience, you should probably stop looking out there and instead start looking in here. And this is what's been going on now in the study of religion, particularly in the cognitive study of religion. I'm not going to get too deeply involved in this, but the overwhelming consensus is that religion is a, or the experience of religion, let's just put it that way, religious experience, if you will, this concept of faith, the notion of belief, however you want to put it, that it is, first and foremost, a cognitive impulse. And it's a cognitive impulse that we are born with. It's something that is part of our human evolution. Now, these issues of, you know, the evolutionary theory and why religion exists, again, these are questions that we've been asking for a really, really long time. You know, if it's true that religion is part of our cognitive processes, then it must be part of our evolutionary experience. There must be some kind of adaptive advantage to religious belief. Otherwise, there's no reason for it to exist. There has to be an adaptive advantage to it. And for about two centuries now, We've been trying to figure out what that adaptive advantage is. And there's been a lot of answers to this question. You're probably all familiar with these answers. Some people will say, well, religion provides social cohesion. So if you are a community with belief, you can survive. You have a greater survival advantage than a community without belief. Maybe. I mean, yeah, it's true that religion can be a cohesive force, but it can be just as much a divisive force. And in any case, for that theory to hold true, there would have to be something uniquely advantageous to religion, something uniquely cohesive about it. And there isn't. In fact, kinship is a far more cohesive and far more stable way of creating a collective identity than religion is. Our ancient ancestors collected themselves based on blood, based on relationship, not based on shared symbols. Others have said, well, okay, you know, religion provides answers to, you know, the mysteries of the universe, these unanswerable questions. Okay, maybe that's sort of true. Not sure how that's an adaptive advantage, necessarily. Not sure how having sort of, you know, airy answers about the mysteries of the universe helps you survive over somebody who doesn't have those answers. That makes no sense at all. There's the Freudian answer, right? That what religion does is it eases anxiety. And by easing anxiety, it provides an adaptive advantage. Freud doesn't know shit about religion. Religion eases anxiety? No. Religion increases anxiety. I mean, think about it. If you think that the entire universe is predicated on whether you make this sacrifice on time or not, that doesn't take away your anxiety. It increases your anxiety. Others have said, well, religion creates morality. That makes sense, right? If you have a divine lawgiver and morals, then you're less likely to go around stabbing the people in your community. And so therefore, you're more likely to survive than a group that doesn't have religion. Again, that's a pretty good answer, except that the concept of religious morality is barely 5,000 years old. The concept of a divine lawgiver is even newer. I mean, forget about going back to our Paleolithic past. Just go back to the gods of Mesopotamia, the gods of Egypt, the gods of Greece, the gods of ancient India or ancient Iran. These were, more than anything else, amoral beings. They were immoral beings, actually. Morality had nothing to do with these ancient religious traditions, let alone going back hundreds of thousands of years. I'm just gonna cut to the chase, okay? The consensus among evolutionary theorists and cognitive scientists now is that there is no evolutionary advantage to religion, and therefore no reason for it to exist. That if anything, it is a disadvantage, again, in terms of the material costs that religious expression asks of you, material costs that could be way, way better spent on, you know, survival. And so there's only one of two explanations. There's only one of two explanations. Either religion is the accidental byproduct of some other adaptive advantage, some other cognitive thing that arose deep in our evolution that actually did have an adaptive advantage, that actually did help us survive, and that religion is just kind of an accident of that thing. It's an echo of that thing. It's a byproduct of whatever that thing is. It's not the thing itself, it's just an echo of the thing that actually matters. And in the book, I lay out this argument in detail. It's a good argument. It's a very good argument. The other position is that we're just made this way. That it's not an accident. That it's deliberate. That it's purposeful. that there is a will behind it, that we are, whatever else we are, homo religiosus. This is who we are. It's how we were made. That it's not some cognitive blip, but a mode of knowing that we are born with. That this notion that there is something beyond the material realm, that this isn't just it, that that's part of our cognitive processes, and that it's there for us to actually reach out and experience that other thing, whatever it is, however you want to define it. There's no proof either way. It's up to you which one of those explanations you accept. It's not my business to tell you one way or another. Again, faith is a choice. What I'm interested, however, is the consequence of this truth that religion is fundamentally a cognitive impulse. And the consequence, as we began in this lecture, is that we have no choice, therefore, but to try to make sense of this thing, this other way of knowing, except to use ourselves as the lens. We have no choice but to think of the divine in human terms, to make God essentially a reflection of ourselves, to envision a God that looks and acts and feels and thinks just like we do. And that, as you can imagine, has some, you know, pretty negative consequences to it. Because if your projection of God is basically just a mirror of everything that you love and you hate, all of your bigotries and biases, your political and social views, your emotions, your motivations, then essentially what you're doing is creating a human being with superhuman powers but with no human limitations. And this, more than anything else, explains why religion has been, throughout human history, both a force for good and a force for evil. Why two people can go to the same exact scripture at the exact same time and walk away with two radically different interpretations of it, because it has far less to do with the scripture than it does with the person doing the reading. When we create God in our own image, we give God all that is good and bad about us, and so therefore, all that is good about and bad about religion is just us. That's what it is. And then, of course, we create our institutions and our societies based on this image of what we think God is, what we think God loves, what we think God hates, which is just what we are and what we love and what we hate. But maybe there's another way of thinking about it. I don't know. Maybe there's another way. Maybe it's possible for us to go back, all the way to our prehistoric ancestors, and to think about the way that they understood the divine, not as a sort of divine personality who looks and acts and talks and thinks just like we do, but instead as the animating force that underlies the entire universe, that is, in fact, the entire universe. There is a term for this. It's a modern word. It's called pantheism. Pantheism is the belief that God is all and all is God. It's a new word, but it's an old idea. It exists in every religious tradition in the world. It's deeply embedded in philosophy. You can even see it in the sciences, in the conception of the preservation of matter and energy, and ideas like panpsychism or the proto-consciousness of the universe. It doesn't really matter where you come at it. What matters is this fundamental truth, a truth that our prehistoric ancestors seem to have known long before they bothered to create gods and religions out of it. And that truth is that all is one and one is all. And it's just up to you to decide what the one is. Thank you very much. Okay. My favorite part.
All right. Which three writers, living or dead, would you invite to dinner party, and what would you serve?
What would I serve? Let's see. So, Fyodor Dostoevsky, my favorite author, the reason that I became a writer in the first place. Love Fyodor Dostoevsky. Probably Margaret Atwood. I've never met Margaret Atwood, but I think, you know, she's so awesome in every way, and it'd be great to have her there. And then, let's see, I don't know, maybe, can I be, like, fancy and say Plato? And just, for no reason other than to just have you go, ooh, Plato. And what would I serve? I think, you know, we'd go to the White House and have McDonald's.
Okay, this is from a friend of the organization named Rod Boutini's out in the audience. And it's very simply, what is worth fighting for?
Very good question. What is worth fighting for? Part of the reason why I'm a pantheist is that I think that when you think of the entire universe as God, that God is the sum of all creation, then it makes it impossible not to understand that all things are God. And if all things are God, then all people are God. And so then you can't dehumanize a person. You can't take away someone's human dignity because they're God. You can't abuse nature. You can't exploit nature because it's God. And if you actually do care about this spiritual experience, then it transforms the way that you react to other people. So the thing to me that is the only thing worth fighting for is precisely that, the dignity of other people. That's the only thing worth fighting for.
If we are somehow, quote, hardwired for religion, are there those of us, and there are those of us who simply don't believe or can't believe, are we sort of incapable of faith or defective?
You're not hardwired towards religion. You're hardwired towards the religious impulse, okay? There's a big difference. Faith and religion are not the same thing. I hope that was very clear. Faith is mysterious, it's ineffable, it's personal, it's a mode of knowing. Religion is how you express your faith. So you are not hardwired towards religion, only insofar as you're hardwired towards any kind of ideology that creates in-groups and out-groups. That's just who we are, it's how we're made in that regard, but not towards religion. If what you're saying, however, is if we're hardwired towards belief, then what does that mean for unbelief? Well, look, there's ample evidence of this already. We've had numerous studies of young children who have come from different backgrounds, different parts of the world, who some of whom are raised in religious communities and some of whom are not. And what we have discovered is that we as human beings are born with an innate conception of substance dualism. What do we mean by substance dualism? We mean the understanding that the mind and the body are separate and distinct. That's not a learned trait. We're just born with that. Now, you could replace the word mind with soul if you want to. You could replace it with psyche if you want to. You could replace it with Buddha nature if you want to. You can call it Brahma if you want to. You can call it whatever you want to. But the point is that we are born believing that there is a distinction between those two things and that we have to unlearn that. Now, does that mean that people who are not believers are going against, you know, their cognitive impulses? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Again, it's just a choice is what I'm trying to say. But what is important is to understand that part of the way that our brain works is by giving us this innate sense that this is not it.
We try to end on a literary note of one kind or another. So there are many students here tonight in the room, and we try to ask our writers, what advice would you give them who would want to be writers themselves?
Well, there's two bits of advice. And I actually gave this one advice earlier when I was meeting with the journalism students. But I think it's good advice for everyone. And it's this. Unless you are willing to treat writing like a job, it will never be your job. I think for a lot of us, we think that writing is this magical thing that happens where the muses come down and rest on your shoulders and the spirit moves you to compose these beautiful words. And that's what writing is. That's what unsuccessful writing is. Yeah. Successful writing is sitting your ass down in front of a computer, whether you feel like it or not, and typing and typing and typing until something finally comes out that makes a little bit of sense, and then doing it again the next day. That's the best advice that I can give you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
That was Reza Aslan speaking as part of PortLarton Lectures in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.